Right, while that's being done, I'll just say something about who I am and just get started. First of all, thanks, Stephen, for that, for setting us up. My name is Jim Christodoulias. I'm not an actuary, but many of my best friends are actuaries. Can I say that? And I also have a lot of admiration for the kind of intellectual rigor that the actuaries I know bring to financial services, so I can say that. But that's not why I'm here. Why I'm here is because I've spent probably the last 4 years of my life writing risk appetite statements of various forms, thinking about risk appetite, and thinking about how to make this thing that I've spent a lot of my personal time on and my team pull sometimes many, many late nights as we get in for the final board submission, how to make sure that that's as meaningful and as relevant to the organization as it can be. So I've got lots of thoughts about that. Not all of them are agreed by everyone, even in my own organizations, but I'm just going to speak freely about that, and I'll share with you some of my experiences. Now, how are we doing on the presentation? All right. So if I hit one of the arrows instead, will that... Oh, all right. Sorry? I do have a USB. No worries. That's fine. All of these slides will be distributed later, so I'll just talk freely and until we get the presentation up. It's typical with these conferences like these. The instructions I got for the presentation was just a title and then a couple of bullet points. So I've organized my talk around a couple of themes. Just one is just this idea of a guide to risk appetite, which Stephen has covered quite well, I think. And the other two points is what I'm going to spend more of my time talking about, which is how do we make sure that it's relevant and influences business decisions? And that's an enormous challenge. And then finally, what are some of the key challenges? But I'd really like to think learnings along the way. And what I want to do is I want to finish the talk by sharing with you some of the things we've tried that have worked really well, some of the things we've tried that haven't worked so well, and then some of the things that, and so we've learned from that as well, and then some of the things that we're still, I suppose, you could call them work in progress. We're still doing. Great. So that's the agenda today. I'm just to make up some time. I'm not going to spend much time on the guide to risk appetite, but I've, just for your reference, because we'll be getting these slides, we've got a couple of slides describing sort of the key terms and the logical flow as we think about them at the National Australia Bank, and also how we think about the different types of risk appetite statements that exist at the board level, at the group level, at the legal entity level, at the business unit level, and then sometimes at a specific activity level. Like we might start at an RPI swaps business, and that will sometimes have its own form of a risk appetite statement. But I won't talk about that other than to say the following important message, which is when we think about the architecture of our risk appetite framework, and we compare it to other institutions that we've had a chance to speak to, or we read documents like the CPS 220 report or the Financial Stability FSR's review of risk appetite and some of the other documents that are referred to in Stephen's paper, I get the impression that there's not much new under the sun. Most people have the same general concept. There are different names in different institutions. We may call something a risk limit. Someone else might call it a risk appetite. Someone else might call it a capital limit, etc. But there's a couple of core concepts that are pretty common among most institutions. So I would propose that the way to win in this space is to take those concepts, and they're always being refined. There's always a better capital metric or a better way to cascade a metric from one level to another. But it's really about making sure that there's as integrally tied to actual business decisions as you can make them. And that's a non-trivial challenge. We haven't fully mastered it, but we've come a long way in the last 4 years. And that's what I'm going to focus most of my talk on. Now, how do we do that? Well, in many ways, it's very fortunate that Joseph came and gave the keynote address. And I will note, I had no visibility in what Joseph was going to say. And so you can draw your own conclusions about how consistent the messaging from the NAB is. And then maybe I'll wait, though, until John Jarrett speaks, and then you can really decide if we're all on the same page. But Joseph said, in his view, risk management and finance and strategy need to be equivalent in terms of the importance as a management discipline within the organization. And that really, for me, sums up how I think about making risk appetite real. It's less about the profession of risk management and the document of the risk appetite statement, but more thinking about how it integrates with a business strategy and with a financial plan. And I'll just go with very simply to how we prepared the financial plan. In the old days, we had a risk appetite statement that was prepared by a team in risk that would go to the board, sometimes in parallel, sometimes following the development of a strategic plan, which had all kinds of management consultancy, you know, concepts about you know, where we wanted to head. And then there was a financial plan that finance would prepare that would put down the numbers that most people at the end were most concerned about, because that laid out the economic outcomes and often the things that would drive executives' performance assessments and bonuses. And so what we said is, really, there's one thing, and that's the plan. And the plan has different lenses. There's a financial lens, which lays out the financial outcomes of the decision we make. There's the strategic plan, which is a qualitative description of what we want to be doing and where we want to head, which also influences the decision we make. And then there's the risk appetite statement, which is just a different lens on those same things. It's ultimately a way to describe the decisions we're going to take, explain why we want to take them, and then lay out the actual steps that we're going to undertake. And so we said we need to have an integrated process that develops all of these things in parallel. And what we started was a planning process that incorporates all of those things. So over the last several years, the team that writes the risk appetite statement, although they exist in risk nominally, I work very closely with my colleagues in strategy and finance. We are constantly, over a multi-month period, we are constantly exchanging drafts and discussing. And so by the time the 3 or 5 year financial plan goes to board, what one reads in the strategic plan and the numbers that one looks at in the financial plan are very consistent with everything that one sees in the risk appetite statement. That's where we are today. I'll express a personal opinion. In my personal view, we will achieve risk appetite maturity when there are no longer three documents. There's just one plan. Right? And if someone says, what's the strategy for the group? We show them the plan. If APRA comes in and says, show me your risk appetite statement, we show them the plan. And if there are any questions that are unanswered after reading that plan, the plan's not done. That's my view. So that's my view of how you will ultimately close this loop best of all. But for regulatory reasons, we have three separate documents that are prepared by three separate teams. And the best we can do is to make sure that those teams are as tightly coordinated, as integrated as possible. So what does a risk appetite statement look like? Well, it starts with a discussion of the environment. How do we see the world? Where do we think we are in the business cycle? We actually take positions on that, and people might wonder, oh boy, what are you, George Soros? No, we're not, but you still have to take a position on things like that. And we also lay out what we think are the most important material risks, and these are sort of global galactic risks that we tend to organize because of the way we're structured as a bank in terms of global macro environment risks, things that are common to all of our regions, things that are specific to the different major regulatory regions where we're located, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, United States, and then finally things that are very specific to our internal environment. Some of which might be familiar to you if you follow the NAB, but most of which, of course, are the kinds of things we would disclose. We then take a couple of very important positions, and we have this concept that we call a risk posture. And a risk posture is, I can define, as a qualitative statement about how we feel about the risk and reward opportunities presented to us at any given time. And we have a risk posture at the group level, and we have a risk posture at every business unit level, and we may have a risk posture at a level of an individual business unit. So we may have a risk posture for mortgage lending through brokers at a particular time. And the risk posture is very simple. It's essentially, are we expansionary, are we neutral, are we conservative? We play these roles. And then we've got subdivisions within that, but it's basically, are we expansionary, are we conservative, are we neutral? And a risk posture is something that can change with every plan. So if you just, it can change for lots of reasons, but I'll give you one for example. Think about the business cycle. You'd want to be conservative. You would have wanted to be conservative in 2005, 2006, 2007. You would also perhaps would have wanted to, could have entertained being a bit more expansionary in 2009, when a lot of institutions were fleeing some very good business. In fact, Joseph, for example, took the opportunity in 2009 to be expansionary using a framework like this and grab some very attractive share in some very attractive segments that was just that were being left on the table in that period. And we had, and his business, I think, had some of the best share gains in those segments that it had ever had, maybe going back to the days of Don Argus and his inflation, or sorry, his recession buster, for those of you who might remember that. So, so it's something that we absolutely correlate to where we think we are in the environment, and not just the macro environment, but the environment for a particular business. But it's also driven by a number of things, which I can talk about later if there's appetite, if there are questions. As I said, we articulate a risk appetite at the group level, and we also have a risk appetite for each of the major businesses, and we will show the board also a risk appetite for every line of business underneath all of those businesses. And each line of business has to justify why they're expansionary, why they're neutral, why they're conservative. We spend quite a bit of time talking about that justification. So what gives you the right to be expansionary? And there could be lots of reasons, but one of the first questions people ask is, well, how have you been doing with the risk capital that we've allocated to you to date? And we look very carefully at return on capital, whether it's regulatory capital, whether it's economic capital consumed, whether it's economic capital allocated, which then allows you to set different limits, etc. We look at the kind of the historical returns. It doesn't mean that a business that just has a strong performance necessarily gets to consume more capital and vice versa, but that's a vigorous discussion, that link between appetite and performance that goes on in this document. It's addressed in the document, and it's a discussion that takes place at our executive and our board. We also have a table that we sort of developed to address something, one of the points that Stephen said. One of the things that we struggle with when we're writing risk appetite statements, and also when we're reading a lot of the kind of documents that go to the board at this time, is motherhood language, which is very easy to find yourself getting into, because you have to say something, and boy, you need it to be right. And a motherhood statement is, per definition, something that is always right. So, we want to say, how can we force ourselves, or force someone else, if we're giving someone a template, to be as crisp and clear about what's going on as possible? So we created this little table, and we use it ourselves, and we hand that out as a template for everyone else who might be writing a risk appetite statement at the business unit or at the activity level. We said, we want you to identify the most important trade-offs that is being agreed to in this plan. And some of them trade-offs are trade-offs which increase risk, and other trade-offs are trade-offs which decrease risk. Right? There are things that we may choose to do to take risk off the table, but those involve some loss, maybe some lost business opportunities, etc. And you know, give each one a label and then describe it using the following template. We choose to, boom, not update XYZ COBOL-based critical piece of infrastructure in order to avoid a $50 million capital spend, for example. And I'm just making this up. This actually isn't one of our trade-offs. Avoid a $50 million capital spend, recognizing that over the next 5 years, the availability of COBOL-trained programmers is diminishing, and we may find ourselves in a position with a critical fault that we can't address. In 2009, it was well known, those of you who have been following the press, that we had formed a portfolio of exposures that were non-core. And we made it clear that we were not going to be taking advantage of opportunities to exit that portfolio in anything like a fire sale basis, even though many stakeholders were asking us to. Our executive and our board made the, at the time, controversial decision that they would slowly wind down that portfolio. That's a decision that was controversial at the time. It worked out for us quite well, but at the time, we didn't know that it would. And so in the FY10 risk appetite statement, in this table was the line that says, we choose to judiciously wind down the SGA portfolio in order to conserve, and we had a broad estimate of what the kind of money that was on the table, this much value for our shareholders, recognizing that there are very realistic scenarios for the UK economy that are being discussed today, and in a number of those scenarios, this is a decision that we might regret, right? And so that was the way we described it to the board, so that there could be no excuses. I mean, you can't avoid bad decisions just by having a risk appetite statement, but it's important that decisions get made are very clear, and then that way there are no questions about who authorized them and why we did that. So this is all about forcing ourselves as an organization to be clear and conscious about the decisions we choose to make, recognizing that whether they're right or wrong will only be determined in history. In any case, it's harder to do than, I'll tell you an aside story, it's harder to do than you might think. So we created this, we got a lot of positive feedback about it. We handed out as a template to a business unit that had to write their risk appetite / strategic plan. And we got it back, and they said, could you take a look at this? This is what you had in mind. I got it, and the first line was something to the effect of, actually, they're all something to the effect of, I'm going to change the words, but this is the idea. We choose to invest in training, compliance training, in order to enhance the skills of our people, recognizing that people are our most important asset. And I said, that's not what we had in mind. That's not what we had in mind. In order to, recognizing that has to be something bad. We have to recognize that these are trade-offs. We're trading off one type of a risk for another, really. And we just need to be clear about what those are. So what are the challenges or lessons we've learned along the way? Well, there are a number of things that we've done over the years which have worked really well. And I would say that they represent, I would be surprised, sort of, as far as we can concern, best practice from what we've seen. First of all, integrate that whole process of integrating it with the strategic and financial planning process, I think has been critical to the success that we've had in terms of elevating risk appetite in terms of people's consciousness and making it more relevant. And in my mind, that will be complete when there is no more risk appetite statement. Also, we've become much more rigorous and disciplined about the whole capital allocation process. We've taken a razor blade to lots of capital allocation limits, which were simply far in excess of what the businesses sensibly need. So we brought a lot of unutilized headroom down. We asked tough questions about why businesses were asking for so much capital when they were typically using so much. And we started measuring businesses not just on the return on utilized economic capital, but also their return on the capital limits that they've been allocated. Because if you're allocated capital, whether you use it or not, it's still allocated. And that's really helped make the economic capital allocation discussion much more meaningful for businesses. Also defining some of the terms, that slide where we talk about what risk posture is and how that's different from risk appetite and what a risk limit is and what a risk aspiration is, all of those things have helped, not because the ideas were new, but having a consistent vocabulary helped in terms of the conversation. And we've also spent considerable amount of time developing internal training materials for not just communicating what the key messages in a risk appetite are, but also helping other businesses make their own risk appetite statements. So we have template documents that people can follow. We have instruction manuals. So if you've got a small business idea, and it could just be at the level of a business idea, I want to get into XYZ specialized finance, which is actually a live example that happened a few months ago. I don't want to make the business case for it, and I'm told I need to also articulate a risk appetite. How do I do that? Well, we can now hand a manual to someone with a template and say, this is broadly, and they'll see a little table like, you know, the risk trade-offs table. They'll see all of that, and they can get a running start by benefiting from our experiences. Some things that haven't worked. In the past, our risk appetite statement was very focused on economic capital and the allocation of economic capital without a discussion or proper discussion of some of the other strategic things we talked about. And that simply wasn't successful. When we sort of started work on this, we went around to our key stakeholders and we said, well, what do you think about the risk appetite statement? And the key message was, it's just, you know, I see a table with allocations of economic capital and that's it. And I don't know how to tie it into anything else. So it's not that we've taken economic capital out of the discussion. It's just that we've added a lot of other equally, if not more important things to that discussion. We also found that past risk appetite statements had far too much risk technical detail. There were way too many. We were asking the board to approve or authorize far too many different limits and settings, et cetera, all the way, you know. And they were having trouble understanding, well, what's the difference between traded market risk economic capital and traded market VAR? And so we took a lot of that out and put it into supporting material. And things that are still work in progress. First of all, making that balance between breadth and depth. Balance between different risk types, credit risk, operation, just talking properly about operational risk. Stress testing, I would say, is one of our biggest, sort of operational risk and stress testing are probably our biggest challenges at this date, and John will talk about, we've hired a huge brain in that space, so we'll talk about that. And then most importantly is this idea of, you know, excuse the Americanism, keeping it real. I'm always stepping back from the document and saying, you know, with all of the T's crossed and I's dotted, is this really addressing the most important things that our CEO and our board need to think about? And you know, making sure that we spend enough time on that is a huge challenge. There was a question. Sorry if I went a little bit over time, but
Yeah. Thanks.